everybody. I'm Ashton Demery.
And I'm Nicole Demery.
And welcome to our Atheist Bible Study.
We're not to sound like super brave or anything, but we're recording during a hurricane right now.
Yeah, well, technically now it's a tropical storm, so we're not those people who just stay in the hurricane despite evacuation orders.
Yeah, we didn't get any evacuation orders this time.
Yeah. Well, if you notice that our voices sound a little bit different, we had to get some new audio equipment because our old one just completely stopped working and has delayed us significantly. So hopefully it sounds better and not worse. Let us know what you think. Today, we're going to finish up 2 Samuel and basically tell more or less the rest of David's story.
Yeah, which is all new stuff to me. I feel like David's reign in my biblical schooling was ended at him killing that wife's husband.
Yeah, that's kind of I feel like the last that I think of with regards to David.
Yeah, and then from
his last big story.
Yeah, because my remembering of David is just he was the greatest king despite, that little bump there. But then the rest of his reign was all glorious. But right. It's not really that.
he's the classic example that gets used to remind us that you don't have to be good to be
God's favorite.
A leader.
Yeah.
This politician did terrible things, but maybe God can use him. Mm-hmm. Maybe God's meant to use him.
So we open up with a story of one of David's sons thirsting after his sister.
Yes.
His half-sister. So we are given this context of Tamar with her relationship to one of her brothers. So this is set up as David's son, Absalom, has a sister named Tamar, which I just think is interesting that her context is set up through the relationship between two other men and isn't just David's daughter, Tamar.
Right. Yeah. They describe it very weird. It's like his brother's sister. It's like, are they not siblings themselves?
Yeah. And then, okay, so we have David's son, Absalom, has a sister named Tamar, who is very beautiful. And another son of David, whose name is Amnon, is just completely lovesick over her. So then kind of later we're told that it's half brothers. But yeah, when you're first reading this story, I almost made a note of are they trying to trick us? Are they trying to make us think that they're not all actually related by doing all of this brother-sister kind of language? But yeah, so basically Amnon and Absalom are half brothers, which makes Amnon and Tamar half siblings as well. So Amnon knows that Tamar is a virgin, and so it's, quote, seemed impossible to do anything to her.
Yeah. I don't know about you. The first time I read that, I understood that as morally it seemed impossible.
I understood that as,
how could he do that to his sister was how I read that initially, which is still bad, but much better than what it actually is.
Yeah. So my interpretation right away was that since she's a virgin, it's going to be very obvious if he tries to fuck her because she's going to bleed and then everyone's going to know or what. I don't know. Not that that's always the, thing that happens. Not everybody bleeds the first time they have sex, but I don't know. There's just this thing in the Bible where somehow there's this very obvious distinction between virgins and non-virgins. So if you fuck a virgin, then it's going to be obvious to everyone that she's no longer a virgin.
Yeah. Well, what I think it really is that he's going to have great difficulty getting her alone because she's a virgin, and virgins are, especially the virgin daughter of a king, is going to be protected. She's not going to be let out of sight and sent off alone out in the wilderness.
Yeah. Okay. So Amnon's friend Jonadab comes up with a plan to get his friend to sleep with his sister. So he tells him to fake being sick and then have his sister bake him some bread and then have her feed him the bread. And so he does this, but it still doesn't quite work. He fakes being sick and then he has all of these people attending to him. So then he has to add to the plan and just be like, hey, can everyone go away? And she just feeds me the food by herself. That's what I would like. That's what would make me feel better.
And he specifically requests it from David too, which is how stupid is David really that he doesn't find anything weird about hey, actually, can you specifically send my one half sister in alone with the bread. Alone, please, Father.
Yeah.
Alone.
Yeah. So he gets her alone and then he tries to rape her and she's, you know, like refusing him and is like, hey, like this is kind of vile. But if you ask my father, I'm sure he's like not going to withhold me from you. So if you go about this the right way, then like you can have me kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. So the half sister thing doesn't seem to be a big part of this discussion at all. Like, because it's like, oh, yeah, well, like we could get married. Like, why don't we just get married?
Yeah.
And he's like, no, we're not doing that.
Yeah. So then he goes forward with the rape, forces himself on her. And then afterward, it's said that he deeply hates her.
Yeah.
So I don't know if the Bible is like trying to make a point of this, but like if I were reading this in another book, like to me, this would mean that like this is symbolic of his internal self-hatred. Like this is a reflection of him, like not on Tamar. This is a reflection of him seeing that he's done this like really awful thing by forcing himself on his sister. And so now instead of like, you know, dealing with him with his own problems, he's projecting it onto her. And so now this woman that he was like so lovesick over that like he absolutely had to have her, like now he like despises the sight of her and just like wants her to leave.
Yeah. I think that's how most modern interpreters would probably see this, is like his like sin, he's like reflecting it on her. Although I don't know that the writers at this time were that nuanced and they're thinking about human emotion. And part of me thinks that for them, it's just like, yeah, like, well, she's worthless now.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's like, that's kind of like the psychology that I see behind it. But like, I also could see men writing this and being like, oh, this is something that like I've experienced. And like, this is what happens when you like rape somebody, like you actually like the thing that you loved, like you now hate.
Yeah.
And that, and them seeing like that being the consequence of it,
right?
And not really like looking at like, you know, men don't want to look at themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
So after this happens, and like now he's like, okay, like get out of my sight. Tamar feels like this is worse for him to do than the actual rape. So like now that he like will not marry her, she says like this is like an even worse sin for you to like not take me as your wife after you've like done this other horrible thing to me.
Right.
Which I think is like a very interesting like cultural
thing. Well, at this time, I think she's correct.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Because one, he's like breaking, you know, Hebrew law in doing so. He's required to or to give like the value of like what he would have to pay to marry her anyways. But it's his family anyway, so I don't really know how that even works. But yeah, her life is completely
ruined. You're right. She is right. Instead of just like one horrible moment in her entire life that she's going to have to deal with forever, like he has now officially like ruined her, the rest of her life. Because again, now nobody is going to want to marry her after.
Yeah, she can never marry and she's going to be treated really as a whore.
Yeah. Like,
they're not going to look at this as his problem. It's her problem.
So Tamar comes away from this and she's like speaking with her full brother Absalom about it. And he tells her not to take it to heart because Amnon is her brother.
Yeah.
She's like, what? That makes it worse.
I was like, what?
Yeah. David finds out, but he does nothing because Amnon is his firstborn.
Right. And that's a very clear violation of the laws of Leviticus. He is required to be shunned by Hebrew society. Amnon is. He should be exiled for this in accordance with Leviticus law. Not for the rape, for having sex with his sister.
Yeah.
But that is the requirement and he's not doing it.
Right. So because of this, Absalom kind of takes matters into his own hands. So he throws a big party and he invites all of the king's sons over to this like big feast. And he tells his servants to kill Amnon once he gets like super drunk. So they have the party. Everybody starts drinking. Once Amnon gets drunk, the servants like carry out Absalom's orders. And this freaks everybody out, obviously. And so all the other brothers run away. So then reports start coming in that like this like feast has happened. And then at first it's like all of his kids are dead. They think that all of David's sons are dead. But then Jonadab clarifies and says, yeah, like, I kind of know, like, what the situation is. And I'd guess that only Amnon is dead.
Right. It's very peculiar, Jonadab to just jump in, like, actually, I'm pretty sure it's just Amnon. It's like,
yeah. He's like, I'm pretty close to the situation. So then he's proven right because all the other brothers come home, proving him correct. And then Absalom runs away.
Yeah, and so he's sort of like exiled now because he's killed his brother. So I guess before we move on, this is, I guess, a good closing up, like, for the story arc here to talk about, like, what this story kind of means to Christians and stuff like that. And so I think one of the more common things I see is this idea that this is David's punishment for Bathsheba, right? Because we talked about, like, he doesn't really get any punishment for that. Like, he loses one child and then has Solomon. So not really, like, a big punishment for David. And so they say, well, this is part of it, right? His whole house is just, like, kind of messed up, which I think, like, this is where one of the big, like, friction points for me and, like, the morality of, like, the Christian religion is that substitutional punishment is just immoral.
Yeah.
It's just, like, it just is. And I think that's interesting because I think there are a lot of Christians who I would generally describe as, like, the reasonable ones, the ones who aren't, like, you know, homosexuality, like, is a sin and, like, we can never allow it. Like, the ones who are think of themselves as more progressive. Even they, right, the like, very center piece of their religion is based in substitutional sacrifice.
Right.
And substitutional atonement for sin.
Mm-hmm.
And they accept that perfectly. In fact, like, that is, like, the foundational, like, part of their religion. And they see it as, like, beautiful.
Yeah. You're, and like, alluding not to Jesus dying for everybody's sin.
Yes. Yeah. Additionally, I found this article by an evangelist named Beth Moore, who is a well-known, quote, progressive evangelist, and the title of it is terrible. It's called Rape and God's Restoration. And so I read it just trying to figure out what she means, because after reading the story, I don't see any real restoration in the story at all.
Mm-mm.
And basically the story she tells is like, yeah, rape is really bad, but you can be sure that God is angry about it. And that's, like, you know, her big, like, driving point, which I don't know if we can, because God doesn't do anything about this. And maybe you could argue that Absalom gets revenge, but we're basically crediting Absalom's actions for God, but we're not crediting him for David's actions of doing nothing.
Yeah.
Which it doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, and this is all very focused on, like, the men's feelings. Like, I'm sure
that doesn't do anything for her.
Yeah, Tamar's life is still ruined from this.
And that's the other point for me is that she closes this out, and this is, like, such, like, a trope for Christians, is, like, to close with a talk about, like, today and, like, how bad today is. And she closes with, we live in an era where women are objectified and demoralized. Oh, yeah, today is that era? Like, really, today, right now, is the era in which that's occurring most prominently compared to this story? That's just, like, taken as, like, gospel for every Christian ever, that now is the worst time to be alive. Things were so much better.
Yeah, I know. Back in these days. Yeah.
And it's, like, it's insane to me because, right, in today's times, we would all accept that that was terrible. There would be prison time for Amnon. And, you know, maybe some people would slut shame her, but, like, for the most part, we would all, like, accept that it wasn't her fault. And in this time, she's going to be punished for the rest of her life for this. And this is a civilization built on the moral foundation of the Hebrew God,
mm-hmm,
and his laws. And that's what his laws are. So, like, I don't know, just, like, I really hate that trope of, like, oh, of course, today, though, is really terrible.
Yeah, like, it's so much worse now. Like, there's so many more rapes and...
Yeah, there's so much more just demoralization, objectification of women. Just, like, because women have the freedom to dress how they want, like, it's worse now than when women were being raped without consequence.
Yeah. It's clarified, like, just so we're not, like, this isn't misconstrued. We're I think both of us agree that things aren't perfect for women right now.
No.
But this is the best time to be a woman, like, in all of human history. Like, we have more rights.
Yes.
Than previously.
What I would say, too, is that a lot of the ways in which they're still bad now is because of the moral standards that were created by this writing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not by the fact that we've left them.
Right. Okay, so we get another story where David has to be tricked into thinking about something as like a third party outsider perspective in order to make a good judgment call on it.
Yeah. Which is interesting because it says at the end of, I think the last section is that David was consoled about Amnon.
Mm-hmm.
So like he's over it, but I guess he's not.
Yeah. So Job knows that David is still thinking about Absalom. So he sets up this little something for an old woman to come in and act like a mourner. So this woman comes in and she starts telling David the story of her sons fighting in a field. And she says that one killed the other. And people think that the murderer should also be killed, even though this would mean that she would be left with no heir. And the woman acts like she really doesn't, even though her son killed her other son, she really doesn't want this son to die.
Right.
And so David promises that no harm will come to her only heir. And then this gives David a revelation and Absalom is asked to return.
Right. And so like she goes further than it too. Like she like he says like, yeah, nothing will happen to your son. And she's like, okay, well, that's interesting because I think that you're doing the same thing. Like she, yeah. Like, she pretty much tells him like, well, like, but you're setting the example.
Yeah, like David doesn't get it. So like,
I'm not sure that nothing's going to happen to my son if you don't like make a better example.
Mm.
And then he's like, all right, where's Job? Job, I'm being punked. Come on out, Job. Fine, Job. Well done.
All right. So this next section, we get a description about how hot Absalom is.
Yeah.
I just want to throw that in there. He's a good looking guy. So Absalom tries to get into contact with Job, but he can't reach him. And he keeps trying, but he, for whatever reason, can't get a hold of Job. So he sets his field on fire. And then Job finally stops by and asks, hey, like, why is my field been set on fire? And Absalom tells him, like, I don't know, man, I just feel kind of weird being back here. Like, I feel like I'm not really forgiven. Like, I'm back, but everyone's kind of treating me weird.
Yeah.
And so Job relays this message to David. And so then Absalom is summoned and forgiven with a kiss.
Yeah.
All right. So now that Absalom is fully forgiven, he starts being a little trickster. So he's
just being a little stinker.
Just being. So he starts waiting outside by the gates. And when anyone comes by to see the king, he tells them that nobody is home. And then he's like, man, wouldn't things be better if I were a judge?
Yeah.
If I could judge all of you.
Like, there's nobody here to judge you, but like, I would do it if...
But I'm here. Like, I could do it. And people are really taken with this. They like this message, and they start to follow Absalom.
Yeah.
And so then he starts sending out messengers to start claiming that he is king.
Yeah. I like the way these priests who are writing this are basically, like, saying, like, yeah, Israelites are complete morons. Our people are complete morons. Mm-hmm. Like, they have like no respect for like the commoners. Like, if they were this stupid, like every loudmouth at a bar would be holding public office. Like, that's like the classic.
You know,
like,
what this reminds me of, you know what this has parallels to? To Trump saying that he won the election.
Yeah. And he's like, oh yeah,
like, if you say it loud enough and long enough times, and never back down.
Yeah. And it's just also just like, to me, is like, you know, everybody's like known some like guy who's just like, oh man, if I like, I could fix all this. Like, I could, like,
yeah, if it were me up there,
if it's you, someone would vote for me, I'd fix all of this. And it's like, yeah, great, man.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so things get so out of hand that David actually has to run away from his own kingdom.
Right.
So he leaves 10 concubines behind to watch his house. And then he goes out. They send the ark out into the wilderness. And now Jerusalem belongs to Absalom.
Yeah. My favorite part is the way that he usurps it, where he just, like, he basically rounds up, like, 200 men. He's like, all right, like, on the count of three, we're all just going to shout, Absalom's the king. Mm-hmm. And that's what they do. They just like shout at the top of their lungs that he's the king now. And everybody's like, oh, it's, I just heard that Absalom's the king. I guess he's the king now.
Well, yeah. And it's the fact that David believes it now too.
Yeah. It's a very fragile monarchy.
Yeah. All right. So David's out. He sets up a spy. His name is Hushai.
Yep.
And then we get this little story while like David is out and about not being king. This guy named Shammai yells at him and throw rocks at David.
Right. And then he also comes across Mephibosheth's servant, Ziba. And Ziba basically like blasts Mephibosheth. And it's like, yeah, man, Mephibosheth's, he's gone to Jerusalem and he's taking back the kingdom of Israel for Saul, for Saul's bloodline, basically, and he's not your, he's against you, basically. And then David like does nothing to this guy Shimei, so his men are like, yeah, let's kill this guy. And then David's like, whoa, like, if the Lord has said to him, curse David, who then shall say, why have you done so? So he's basically like, yeah, we like, if God has, you know, made this guy go and throw rocks at me and curse me, then like I shouldn't do anything about it. But like, it's also like an answer for why you shouldn't do anything about anything.
Yeah.
It's like he's killed men for much less, for like coming and telling him like, hey, I saw Saul die. And true. He's like, I'm going to kill you for that. It's like, well, what if God told him to come tell you that?
Yeah. Yeah. So back in Absalom's little council, he's like getting advice on what to do next. And this guy named Ahithophel tells him that he should sleep with the 10 concubines left behind, because this will really show everybody, you know, that he's the guy in charge now.
Yeah.
And he should also go out and attack David. And so the council of Hushai, who is David's spy, says, like, I like the concubine part.
That's a really, yes.
We can keep that in, but I don't know about the attacks. And he says that David probably isn't with the troops anyways, and that his troops will likely defeat them, and so then the people will lose faith in him. He says, like, what you should actually do is you should go out with your warriors to go find David.
Yeah.
Basically setting him up to get himself killed.
Right.
So Hushai goes back to David and he warns him of this impending attack. And David is like, you know, there's about to be this like confrontation, and he wants his men to go easy on Absalom because he's his son and he still loves him, even though the whole like insurrection thing.
Yeah. And he wants to go with him, and then he's told no.
Yeah.
By his men.
Yeah. During this battle, Absalom is riding on a mule and gets his head caught in a tree. So then this idiot is just hanging by his head in a tree for just anybody to come up and kill him.
Yeah, apparently he's alive hanging by his head in this tree.
Yeah. So somebody comes and he sees that Absalom is stuck in a tree by his head, and he goes to report this, and he's asked, like, okay, well, why didn't you just kill him? And he's like, well, I didn't want to be the one to kill the king's son. And Job is like, I don't have time for any of this.
Right. And David specifically told them not to, too.
Yeah. So Job finds Absalom, kills him himself. With Absalom dead, this one kid is like super excited to go give David, you know, like the tidings.
Yeah.
And Job, who knows that David is not going to be happy to hear that his son is dead, is like, oh, I wouldn't say you're bringing tidings this time. Maybe you can bring tidings like another time. And he's like, hey, you Cushite, why don't you go deliver the news to David? So this guy takes off running to go deliver the news to David. And this other kid is like, well, I still want to go deliver the news. And Job is like, why? Like, you're not going to get like an award for giving this news to David.
Yeah.
And he's like,
the last two guys died. That's why I sent the Cushite.
Yeah.
Nobody cares about that guy.
So he's like, I'm going to go anyway, and I'm going to run the whole way there. So a sentinel is like up in the post. He sees not one, but two men, you know, running. And so he's like, oh, these people must have good news because yeah. They're running over here. There's kind of like this like way too much explanation for the order of like who tells David the news. But basically both right. of them tell David that his son is dead. And as expected, David is super bummed out about this.
Yeah. I don't know why they go to so much detail to like, to basically like let us know that this guy is like, he's like Jesse Owens. Like he's super fast, you know. They make like a big point about how like he runs and then he passes the Kushite who left a while ago. And then he's the first one there and they want you to know that he's really fast. I don't know if that's going to come up later or what.
No, I don't. Yeah. So David, instead of letting his people like celebrate this like great victory, you know, over David's enemies, he makes everybody mourn instead. So he's like really sad and he makes everyone else be really sad about it. And the soldiers, they don't get any kind of like proud return from battle, like, you know, what they're expecting. They just kind of like slink back into the city and they're super, you know, ashamed because they are a part of this killing of David's son.
Yeah.
So then Job, who's honestly like the real leader, like he, behind all of this, like he kind of sets everything in motion.
He's pulling the strings because he like keeps killing people and doing whatever he wants and getting away with it.
Yeah. So Job goes to David and is like, dude, you need to pull yourself together. Like, this is embarrassing for everybody that you are once again crying over people who have wronged you.
Yeah.
And you're bumming everybody else out too, making them feel bad for like taking down your enemies. So like, you need to get your ass out there and you need to speak kindly to them and like let them know that you appreciate them. Otherwise, nobody is going to be following you come morning.
Right.
So then David heeds this good advice.
Yeah.
And yeah, makes nice with everybody.
Yeah.
And then there's this whole little thing about him being recalled to Jerusalem.
Yeah, this part's kind of confusing. You just like, it says that the people are disputing and asking, why do you say nothing about bringing our king back? And I don't know who they're talking to. Like, is this a fourth wall break? Yeah. And David sends word and he's like, hey, why have you guys not called for me to come back? And it's like, is that, I don't, like, why is that necessary? Like, why doesn't David just come back? Because he has the army at this point. He tells Amasa, like, hey, if you, you know, get the people to bring me back, I'll make you commander in place of Job. And so Amasa, like, goes and, like, tells everybody, gets everybody to, like, be like, yeah, like, let's bring the king back. And then they go meet him at the Jordan. Mm-hmm. And then Shimei and a bunch of Benjamites show up for it, too.
Yeah. And then while Shimei is there, he apologizes to David and then David forgives him for the whole like throwing and yelling of stones thing.
Right.
Then David meets up with Mephibosheth again, who is a complete mess. Like his beard is all grown out and his feet are dirty. There is some kind of miscommunication about a donkey.
Yeah. So what happens here is basically Mephibosheth is telling David, my servant lied to you, right? He was supposed to be getting a donkey ready for me so I could go with you. And then he lied to you and told you that I was your enemy, basically. Which is a really weird, like, turn of events. Like, why have this whole story where Mephibosheth is now the bad guy and then actually, like, his servant lied. In the end, David's like, you and Ziba can just, like, split the land because he had given it all to Ziba because he was, like, Mephibosheth is a traitor. But I think what's, like, happening here is there's, like, inconsistency among the guild about, like, where they stand on the Benjaminites. Like, there's certain, like, parts where they're trying to, I think, sort of make out the Benjamites as, you know, the bad guys or, like, you know, not the best tribe. And that's really whenever they, like, make Saul the bad guy or make Saul's descendants the bad guy, that's what they're doing. And then there's sort of these redemption arcs that come in with, I think, a set of priests that want to push a more favorable view of the Benjamites. And we'll see that again shortly.
So then David invites an old man named Barzillai to live with him, but he doesn't want to, so he does not.
Yeah, he sends Chimcham instead. Who I don't know if that's his son or who that is.
Yeah. Then we get a story about Sheba, who is a scoundrel and a son of a Benjamite.
Yep.
And for whatever reason, the people start following this guy now. But Judah sticks with David.
Yeah. And so we're pushing back in the other direction again
with
the Benjaminites and again making Judah the hero.
Yeah. So then, once again, David leaves 10 concubines in a house, but this time he never sleeps with them again. And we needed to know that.
And was it, I forget, was there something that they did?
I don't know. I don't think they did anything. Maybe it was, I have no idea. Maybe it's, did they get slept with Absalom? Did Absalom go through with that?
Probably, but I don't, I don't know if that.
Anyways, doesn't really seem relevant to the story. They're going to go fight Sheba. Job meets Amasa on the battlefield. He goes to kiss him, and then he stabs him in the stomach.
Murders him.
Yep.
Straight up.
And that's fine. Nothing else comes of that.
Yeah, there are literally no consequences for this.
Not even mentioned again.
Yeah.
So then a woman who is, like, on the other side of things comes to Job and is like, hey, why are you coming to destroy Israel? And he's like, my hands are kind of tied in the situation because of this guy named Sheba. And so the woman is like, okay, I'm going to go get my people to cut Sheba's head off and then throw it to you all. And then will things be fine then? And he's like, yeah, that would about do it. So then she goes back, gets her people to do this. This happens, and then things are fine.
Yeah. It makes me wonder, though, if this was one of those, like, cities of refuge or whatever.
Mm. Oh, with, like, all the prisoners?
Yeah, I remember,
not
like,
prisoners, but bad people. To, yes, I know what you're
trying. Yeah, it's like, was she supposed to do that, you know? Like, we're not going to talk about it at all, I guess, but.
Yeah.
Why didn't he just flee to one of those?
Adding to David's great reign, now there's a famine over the land. And this is because Saul killed some Gibeonites during his reign.
Which I looked into has never been mentioned before.
Okay.
I wasn't sure if, like, I'd just forgotten about it. So I, like, went back and there's no mention of Saul doing any of this. It's just now being brought up.
Okay. So David goes to the Gibeonites and starts having conversations with them about reparations. Says he's going to get everything they want, but the people just want blood. So they
just blood.
So they ask for 7 of Saul's children to be killed, impaled, and left out.
And David's like, sure.
Yeah, he's like, seems reasonable.
I don't have any love for Saul's family.
Yeah. Except for Mephibosheth.
I would never take issue with anybody killing Saul or any of his descendants.
Yeah.
Like, what?
I've never cried any over.
There was all this high ground, and then now somebody just asks him, hey, can I kill these guys? Yeah, seems fair.
Yeah. Got to get rid of the famine.
And again, substitutional punishment here.
Yes, yeah, which is.
Some of them are like grandchildren.
Yeah. So Saul's concubine protects the bodies so that, like, birds and things don't destroy them. And then eventually David has them taken down and buried.
Yeah. And so this part's another confusing part with, like, Saul's descendants, because it's very, like, who are Saul's descendants is not clear in the Bible.
Right.
So we talked a little bit about this before, right? The First Samuel says he had Jonathan, Ishvi, and Malchishua, and then daughters Merab and, was it Michal or Michael? Either way, those were his only children, basically, is what First Samuel 14 tells us. But then at his death, First Samuel 31, it was Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. And those, it says, are like all of his sons are now dead. So, you know, some basically say that Abinadab and Ishvi are the same people. And even if that was true, one, why is it within, like, theoretically the same priestly guild, like, should be writing these? Why are they switching names here?
Mm-hmm.
And then that's all of his sons. And then suddenly we get Ishbal out of nowhere, when all of Saul's descendants are supposed to be dead at this point. And then we also have the sons of his concubine, which are never mentioned before right now. This is the first time we have mentioned. We knew about Rispa. We did not know she had sons until right now. And one of their names is Mephibosheth. But that's not the same Mephibosheth, because Mephibosheth is Jonathan's son.
Yeah.
Which is... why, I don't know, it's a strange reuse of a name there.
Yep.
And the other one is Armani. So one Mephibosheth is spared and one Mephibosheth is killed. And we don't know what happened to Ishvi. Nobody ever says what happened to Ishvi, if Ishvi is in fact a real son of Saul.
Okay, so then David goes back to, you know, his usual, which is fighting the Philistines. Except he's getting old and tired. So he's out there and he almost gets himself killed. And the men are like, hey, maybe you should stop coming with us to these things, because if you die, then, you know, this whole thing is kind of goes out.
Yeah.
So then we get some exploits of what David's men do without David, and they're out there killing giants,
yeah,
including a man with 6 fingers and 6 toes.
Yeah. And another Goliath.
Yeah. Then we get a little David's Thanksgiving, which is just a little song that David sings to the Lord. Then we get the last words of David, which are not actually David's last words, because he does not die.
Yeah. So the Song of Thanksgiving, there's not a lot of interesting stuff in there, like mostly just, we love God. But one part that I thought was interesting was, The Lord rewarded me according to my righteousness. According to the cleanness of my hands, he recompensed me. For I have kept the ways of the Lord and have not wickedly departed from my God. For all his ordinances were before me, and from his statutes I did not turn aside.
Okay.
I was blameless before him, and I kept myself from guilt. That is interesting.
Bit of a...
I feel like there were a couple of statutes there.
You feel like you're missing a few
such
things.
Such as adultery and murder that were violated, in fact.
Yeah. Then we get some more descriptions of what David's men are doing. Do you know anything interesting in there?
Nah, I didn't really find anything of interest.
Neither did I.
Just a list of warriors.
Yeah. Then David is told to take a census, and so he does. And then he gets punished for taking the census.
Yeah.
Like to explain
God,
that.
God demands that God says, why have you not counted the people of Israel and Judah? And David's like, you're right, I'm sorry. Job, go do it. And Job's like, why are we doing this census? And David's like, fucking do it. So he does. And they get 800,000 men in Israel, 500,000 in Judah. And then next we get the judgment of David's sins, which David's filled with guilt over doing the census for some reason. And then he starts begging for God's forgiveness. And it feels a little bit like God's like, oh, yeah, sure. I guess I'll punish you.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, you did do something really bad, David. And then he gives him three options. He's being a little more democratic these days. And he says, okay. I don't remember what the options were, actually.
So it's either 3 years of famine, 3 months of fleeing for his foes, or 3 days of pestilence in his land.
Right. And so, of course, he chooses 3 days, because that would be stupid not to.
Yeah.
And it happens, and then at some point, David is begging for God to punish him and not the people anymore.
Yeah, there's a talk about an angel. So an angel is the one who is bringing the pestilence
right.
to the land, and... David speaks to the angel directly and is like, it is enough. Now stay your hand. He says like, you know, I alone have sinned. So, you know, punish me.
Yeah. So anyways, what happened here? Why did God tell David to do this and then change his mind and decide to punish him for this? And that's a question that many have asked before. So some of this comes from a future passage that's in Chronicles that is going to sort of contradict this story or create a different version of the story, and there's a little more to talk about there, but I'm going to talk about other stuff for now, and we'll kind of get there later. But God Questions argues that Bible doesn't actually say that God told him to do it, because the word incite doesn't have a subject in the Hebrew translation. Basically, like, well, actually David did this on his own. It had nothing to do with God. Basically David's like feeling concerned about like, can we protect, right? Can we fight a war right now? Are we going to be overcome by our enemies? So I need to count the people. And so like, because he didn't have faith in God, that's why he's being punished. It's not a very good argument, because regardless of whether the word insight has like a subject associated with it specifically, the word Yahweh is definitely at the very beginning of the sentence. And just the structure of the sentence suggests that Yahweh is the one who's inciting this. Like it has to be. And then there's also a blog post that I found called it's on the Spiritual Beginner, and it suggests that it's because David took the census without the required tax that was done in Numbers and Exodus. So in Numbers and Exodus, there's the census that's taken, right? So it seems strange that we're saying that a census is a sin, because they did several.
Already done
of them.
One of those, yeah.
But those required them to pay like a tax to the temple. And they're saying that David didn't take the required tax when he did the census. So the census was fine, but he didn't tax them, which, I mean, it basically says as clear as day here that David felt guilty for counting the people, and doesn't say anything about like any.
I didn't charge him.
Yeah, there's nothing about that. And then lastly, I think this is the most interesting one, and it comes from a more Jewish interpretation and discussion on the Judaism stack exchange. It comes from a medieval philosopher named Maimonides, and basically it's like this is all figurative, right? So for Maimonides, he doesn't see any of the anthropomorphic aspects of God as being real. Like he thinks of in the Torah, whenever it talks about God wanting something or like inciting something, that it's sort of metaphorical. And so like all the things that are like God sort of creates the like rules and the laws of nature, and then those laws of nature just punish you on their own. And so what he's saying is that David decided to take the census himself. So when it says God incites him to do it, that's just sort of like David's nature really incited him to do it, because that's how David's made.
Okay.
And then he takes the census, and now the information gets out that of how many people are in Israel. So now the enemies are like, oh, they're weak, right? We can take them. So then they come in and they kill a bunch of people, and there's mass death. Well, there's a bunch of death or a bunch of dead people, and they can't deal with all the like the bodies. So now there's a plague because of the, you know, the sanitation issues, and there's these sort of natural consequences for David's actions. And the laws of nature have just sort of acted in this way and tell this story.
Kind of sounds like that guy didn't even really believe in a God.
He kind of didn't. And I mean, he was definitely, from what I've read, he's controversial for that reason, that he interprets this all very differently from other interpreters, you know, Jewish or Christian. But I think that's a really interesting way to look at it, and might, like, I don't know, maybe it's a more useful way to look at the Bible. Maybe you can like make better sense of what's going on here if you like, I guess just if you like understand the world as having like natural action and consequences. To me, that's a little bit more sensible than trying to make all the things that are happening here seem right, I guess.
Yeah.
Whenever Christians try to justify God killing a bunch of people in the Bible, right? It's just, it's abysmal. Like, it's just like, yeah, well, they actually deserved it, even though you don't see that in the passages here. There's more that we don't know about how bad these people were, and they really deserved it. Whereas if you think of it this way, it's a little bit more like, it's just like things happen. People, you know, diseases happen and like wars happen. And that's just like the laws of nature.
Yeah. I agree with you. I just, like, what's the point then? You know, of writing all this down and saying that there's a God, if it's meant to be interpreted as people are just people and everything has consequence. Like, that just seems like, yeah, that's like how, yeah.
That's fair, yeah. And I think that's probably one of the criticisms of that guy's philosophy. Although I think he does, from what I understand, like, think of the laws of this text as very real, right? Like, those are actually the laws of nature, right? That you should not murder and, you know, all that, all the commandments and stuff like that, I think he takes seriously, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, he's not Christian, right? Because you can't really make the New Testament metaphorical in the same way that you can try to make this metaphorical.
Yeah. I don't know. For me, like, my sisters have tried to argue that the Old Testament is just metaphors and stuff. And it just kind of drives me insane. It's just kind of like, you don't like it, like you don't like the Old Testament, so now you're just gonna go and say that this is all just like a metaphor, or like, it just seems like, no, you all need to take some fucking responsibility for what is in this book that you hold up so high. And, you know, some of them do, and it's like, or not that they take responsibility, but, you know, like fundamentalists are like, yep, all this is here, all this is true, all this is good. So I'm not saying I agree with that either, but like, I don't know. I just think it's a cop out. I don't think you get to say, oh, well, this is just a metaphor.
Yeah. For them, like, they don't really say all of it's a metaphor. It's just the parts that can be proven wrong. It's just the parts that are like 7 days to create, you know, everything, right? They'll be like, oh, yeah, that's just metaphorical. It's like, that's only because now we can very easily prove that that's not true. Whereas I think they see other parts of it. Like, I think they really think Moses existed.
Yeah, I know.
So, like, that's even worse, right? And it's also one of those things where they call, like, the God of the gaps, right? The God's, like, the big, powerful God who did everything up until the point that science proves that we didn't need him for this or that, right? And that's, like, what Christians are doing now, where it's, like, it only becomes metaphorical because we proved you wrong, right? Instead of, like, abandoning this as a source of truth, right? You're, like, this is a source document. This tells us how it went. And it's, like, well, actually, I guess it's wrong. Maybe I shouldn't treat this as, you know, my source for knowledge. Mm-hmm. They're like, well, the rest of it's still a source of knowledge.
Yeah.
Whereas this guy was around when everybody thought, you know, very much believed all of this and,
right,
you know, started talking about it metaphorically. I think there's a better explanation for this contradiction, because, like, it'd be one thing if these were completely different, like, books of the Bible written at different times and they contradict each other. I think that's more easy to discuss why. But I think First Chronicles, when we get there, is, I think there's a little bit better a explanation for what really went down here, as far as, like, what they were thinking when they wrote it.
Got it. So that is the end of Samuel?
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, all of Samuel, but yeah, all that was 2 Samuel.
And then now we're going to be moving on to Kings.
Yeah, so thanks for listening. Bye, y'all.
Bye.